You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Program. We've got a great show for you lined up today. In hour two, we're going to be talking a lot about political technology. But first, I just want to talk about something that really bothers me. After, you know, what seemed like an eternity of Mitt Romney going all over the country and or all over Europe, embarrassing the United States, especially surrounding the Olympic Games, we've now got the crazy anti-tax people embarrassing themselves to make partisan political points surrounding the Olympics. If we can just play that clip that we queued up, it's just disgusting.
Well, technically, it's not just cash that you have to pay taxes on. If you receive a prize for winning anything, and that's a refrigerator on a game show, that's an Olympic gold medal, it doesn't have to be cash. You have to pay taxes on the fair market value of that. So what we did at Americans for Tax Reform is we took a look at what the fair market value of a gold medal would be based on what its alloy composition was and based on commodity prices.
Which they say, here's what they came up with, and this is where the BS comes in. They say that if you win the gold medal, then you're going to pay a medal tax of $236 and a cash prize tax of $8,750 for total taxes of $8,986. For the silver medal, it's a $135 medal tax, $5,250 prize tax for a total of $5,385. And for the bronze, $2 medal tax, $3,500 in cash prize taxes for a total tax bill of $3,502. As the good people at Media Matters are quick to point out, first of all, that clip you heard was obviously from Fox News, and the gentleman on it that was speaking is from the Americans for Tax Reform. And if it sounds familiar, it should. That's Grover Norquist's organization. You remember Grover Norquist. He's the anti-tax lobbyist and, you know, congressional gridlock kingpin that rules Congress with an iron grip. He doesn't want anybody raising taxes on anything for anything, even during war. You know, we should just cut, you know, people off of Medicare and food stamps and hot meals for kids to pay for our wars instead of making maybe the wealthy pay their fair share. Anyways, that's who's behind this bogus baloney. As the good people at PolitiFact point out, they rated this claim mostly false. PolitiFact noted that Americans for Tax Reform's calculations assume the prizes will be taxed at the top income tax rate, despite the fact that many Olympic athletes earn far less than that. PolitiFact also noted the calculations assume the medalists will fail to deduct any business expenses for their winnings. Both of those things are wildly unlikely to happen. First of all, most Olympic athletes are not huge winners. They're not all Michael Phelps. Second of all, you know, if you are in that top tax bracket, you can afford to pay these taxes. And third of all, the idea that folks wouldn't have business expenses associated with their profession is just ridiculous. Your training, all the, you know, your travel for work, all of that stuff, that gets to be deducted when you're in that kind of a business. What this is just another example of right-wing Republicans who have never met a tax they didn't, you know, want to get rid of, except for taxes on the poor, you know, trying to make politics here with the Olympics. It's just as embarrassing, if you ask me, as Mitt Romney and his gaffes aplenty abroad. I did want to let you know that we've got a new poll question up on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/Carl Frisch, we're asking everybody today their opinion on why is Mitt Romney hiding his tax returns. You know, he hasn't released more than a year's worth, and even that 1 year's worth isn't complete. We want to know what you think. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466, and we'll take your answers. But you can also answer these poll questions on Facebook, facebook.com/Carl Frisch. Here are some of the suggested answers we've got up, and you can feel free to insert your own answer. He didn't pay any taxes for a number of years despite making buckets of money. That's option number one. Option number two, He has so much hidden in Swiss bank accounts that they named an army knife after him. Number three, he took a loss on purchasing 2002 Olympic pins with his likeness on them. And four, he and his wife have more than one dancing horse. So that'd be kind of embarrassing, especially since he has no interest in the sport whatsoever. All right. I've been shocked at the way that Congress has been behaving, and I'm not the only one. Let me give you an example. There's a congressman he's a six-term Republican congressman from Arizona. His name is Jeff Flake. I believe he's running for the Senate. And he, this is ridiculous. He has confirmed he is not among the 82% of Americans who think insurance companies should be banned for denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. That's right. Congressman Jeff Flake thinks that insurance providers, their interests are more important than the interests of everyday Americans. It's quite real. So he says in a recent debate, and this is from Think Progress, in a recent debate for an NBC affiliate in Arizona, Flake explained that doing so would end the industry as we know it, which sounds like pretty decent to me. I wouldn't mind that at all. If you ask me, they could use some ending. He said, if individuals are allowed to access healthcare services only when they are sick or injured, there is no reason for anyone to have insurance. If insurance companies are required to accept all pre-existing conditions, insurance is no longer insurance. Think about that for a second. It shows remarkable lack of understanding about how insurance works in the first place and what a pre-existing condition means. For example, somebody with asthma may not always be symptomatic of having asthma. They may not be having an asthma attack 24 hours a day, and frankly, in most cases, they aren't. But in theory, an insurance company could deny coverage to that person. That's because they have a pre-existing condition. Apparently, what Jeff Flake thinks is that if you are perfectly healthy, only then should you be able to have insurance on the off chance that you get hurt or come down with something that you didn't have before. Obviously not the point of having, insurance. The point of having insurance is to take care of, is to pool risk so that you don't have to pay the same exorbitant costs that it would, be to pay for your illness or pay for your injury. It's just ridiculous. It's not surprising. These Republicans in Congress, I'm not the only one, by the way, who has been outraged by the behavior of Republicans in Congress. We've also got Steve LaTourette. He's a congressman from Ohio who recently announced that he would not be running for re-election. He called Grover Norquist and his tax views crap, and he called Congress an alcoholic. Retiring Rep. Steve LaTourette offered the scathing assessments Thursday of Congress and of the tax policy pushed by his party and Grover Norquist. I think he should be applauded. And the reason that this story matters is because more and more people like Steve LaTourette are being driven from the Republican Party. You know, in 2006, 2008, almost every single Republican in New England was wiped out. They lost because there was no room for moderate Republicans anymore in the Republican Party. You can interchange the word sane for moderate if you like. And now it's gotten to the point where these moderate, people like Steve LaTourette, who was mildly pro-union, they don't have room in their own party. They don't have room to move up the ladder. You have to be a Tea Party nut to get ahead. It's just sick. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon today and tomorrow. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back with your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we're taking your calls. Why won't Mitt Romney reveal his taxes? I didn't really steal the show. Tom's just out for a few days, filling in for Tom Hartman on his show today. I am Carl Frisch. I'm a Democratic strategist, syndicated columnist. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's K-A-R-L FRISCH.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch, and go to Facebook and answer today's poll question, Facebook.com/Carl Frisch. We want to know why you think Mitt Romney won't release more tax returns, leading the pack in terms of the answers to the questions thus far. In first place, we have he didn't pay taxes for a number of years despite making buckets of money. In second place, he has so much hidden in Swiss bank accounts, they named an army knife after him. In third place, he took a loss on purchasing 2002 Olympic pins with his likeness on them. And in fourth place, he and his wife own more than one dancing horse, so that's obviously a problem. Speaking of the dancing horse, we were talking at the top of the show about this ridiculous right-wing story that's been moving around the internet and on Fox News and on, you know, right-wing talk radio. So obviously it's eating up a lot of airtime and bandwidth in the right-wing noise machine, where it's basically the story of fool's gold. Fox News pushing this shady story from the Americans for Tax Reform that, you know, Olympic gold medalists will basically go bankrupt paying taxes on their gold medals. First, we should be so lucky that a large number of Americans will walk away with the gold. I think that'd be wonderful for our country. Second, I'm not surprised that Fox News, talk radio, you know, right-wing talk radio and people like the Americans for Tax Reform are already ready to politicize this story. I gave you the breakdown before. Basically, what they're saying is that because of the content of the medals in the prizes, gold, silver, bronze, along with the cash value of the prizes, these athletes are going to be paying, you know, buckets of money when it comes to taxes. It's just not true. Most athletes at the Olympics are not in the top income tax bracket, which these numbers from the American Tax Association, you know, uses to get them to these giant tax numbers. And number two, if they are in the highest tax bracket, they can afford this. Let me give you an example. Shana, who's helping out today, as he always does with Tom, reminded me. I mean, I was just talking about the Romney's dancing horse. Did you know that in addition to Mitt Romney and Ann Romney's dancing prancing horse, Rafalka, getting the treatment by a sports psychologist? I'm not kidding. They hired a sports psychologist to work with their dancing horse. In addition to that, the Romneys claimed $77,000 in tax write-offs on that horse. So, as PolitiFact points out, one of the things that the Americans for Tax Reform failed to do was to think about the fact that these athletes will have lots of things that they can write off, just like the Romneys did on their psychologically trained horse, who likes to dance. At least I presume it likes to dance. It looks pretty jaunty when it's out there doing its dressage. Dressage. I don't think anybody, certainly Mitt Romney doesn't know how to pronounce it. But we want to know what you think. Why won't the Romneys release more taxes? We've got some calls on the subject. So why don't we go to Jay in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jay. What do you think?
Hey, how you doing, Carl?
Good. How are you?
I think I'm wonderful. And by the way, I love you, and I love you when you're on Stephanie Miller. You do a great job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think the reason that you left out was I think Romney was one of the millionaires that was given amnesty to bring money back in the mid-2000s. I think he's afraid to let us know.
Well, it'd be interesting. It certainly would. You know, one thing that's interesting is that I remember reading recently that some of the guys at Bain Capital presumed that Mitt Romney was never going to release his taxes. And, you know, what's fascinating to me is that John McCain's campaign team saw more than 20 years worth of Mitt Romney's taxes. So they know what's out there. And if it's good enough for John McCain and his team, it should be good enough for us. Now, I will say, John McCain's team saw 20 some years of Mitt Romney's taxes, and they still chose Sarah Palin as his running mate. So maybe there's a lot more there, than we know. Let's see here. Why don't we talk to Jim in Worcester? Hey, Jim.
Hey. My comment is why not be against tax?
What's that?
My comment is why not be against every tax you can get your hands on? That comes.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jim. I support tax relief for consumers and working people, because they're the ones that keep this, the economy going strong. Rich people in this country have never paid less in taxes, and they've never done better economically. And yet that's not translating into jobs. What we need to do is make sure that working people have more money to spend so that they can, you know, fire the economy along. And Republicans don't want to do that. They just want to keep giving tax cuts to their super wealthy friends who have never done better. Who have never done better. And if you listen to right-wingers, they'll tell you in times of great economic, times, well, you don't want to slow down the economy by taxing the super wealthy. And if, in times of horrible economic times, they'll tell you, you don't want to slow down the economy by taxing the super wealthy. It's just not true. It never has been. It never has been. So, I don't know. I think the idea that we shouldn't pay any taxes is just ridiculous. And thank you for your phone call on a line that was probably installed with the use of federal tax dollars. Let's go really quick to Dave in Murphy's, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Carl, and I like your style.
Thank you.
I have a couple comments about Congress and vulture capitalism.
Yes.
Congress is the ones that changed the law so that pensions could be raided
right.
by these capitalists. So aren't they the original vulture capitalist, and aren't they doing that to the post office? Isn't that money going to go straight away, just like Social Security, into an IOU?
Yeah, I kind of picture Republicans in Congress not as the original vulture capitalist, but perhaps the drought that created the weather conditions that allowed vultures to kind of seize on weary prey. I don't disagree in the slightest. I think Republicans... in Congress who have set us up in this way have a lot to answer for. But you let us know what you think. Give us a call, and we'll take it after the break. For the Tom Hartman Program, Filling In Today, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we'll look at the political landscape with Democratic strategist David Bender, my good buddy.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch. Good to be with you. Joining us now, right before he boards a plane, is my good friend and the insanely smart Democratic strategist, David Bender. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm actually on the plane, Carl, so I'm not sure whether this is...
I will not make you pull an Alec Baldwin, but just really quick before they force you to turn off your mobile device...
I have a seven-letter word here. And by the way, when malware is involved in Defense Department pornography, can they ask that, or do they have to tell?
It's a good question. I don't think that they allow mail-on-mail, phishing. But
mail-on-malware.
Right, mail-on-malware. I'm curious. So we've been asking listeners to vote online for why Mitt Romney won't release his taxes, facebook.com/Carl Frisch. I'm curious... How big of a thing do you think this is going to continue to be, and how quickly will it force Romney to get his running mate announced?
Well, I think the running mate is definitely in the works. If you don't have your mobile app by now to get the Mitt Romney running mate, I can't imagine why. What's astonishing about this is that people should be running after John McCain. John McCain has read 23 years of those facts.
Right.
Let him explain why it is that when he read them, he thought Sarah Palin was the better choice. Even if Dick Cheney doesn't agree, the whole thing is not, as it happens, a tempest in Teapot Dome. Ooh. what it really is a reflection of the arrogance and sense of entitlement that Mitt Romney has displayed throughout his career.
And don't you think we saw that on display during his trip abroad? I mean, don't you think that sense of entitlement where it's like, well, you know, we did a great job with the Olympics. I don't know how the British are prepared. Isn't that where that all comes from?
It's where it all comes from. But one of the interesting things, Rachel did this last night. If you go back and look at his race for governor, and Carl, because, as you know, I go back in politics to Grover Cleveland, second term.
Right, second term.
My memory, sadly, reminds me of how Mitt Romney ran for governor and how he left being governor. He had in his home state a level of 60% disapproval. That's why he didn't run for a second term.
Right.
There's a national headquarters for Romney for president in Boston, but virtually no campaigning unless they need a photo op at a factory that he didn't close down. And this will represent, and here's a little known but fairly significant fact. If Romney, through some vagary of electoral college law, should wind up winning this election, he will be the first president to win without carrying his alleged home state since Woodrow Wilson in 1916, almost a century.
Wow.
He's not campaigning in the state that knows him best. And that, I think, should be something that we point out over the next 97, 98 days.
Well, and he might even not only lose his adopted home state, he might even lose his birth home state of Michigan.
That seems even much more likely,
yeah.
When you say, you know, Romney to Detroit, drop dead.
Well, and now you've got Mitt Romney trying to smear the president by saying that the president cost us jobs by saving the auto industry.
Yeah. Yes, and that dog won't hunt. let me also say, Carl, because I know that you and Bullfight Strategies look at these things every day. The presidential race right now in August, when anyone tells you that if the election were held today, President Obama would win the swing states and likely win re-election.
Yeah.
Anyone who uses the phrase, if the election were held today, has never done a campaign in their life because the election
Indeed.
Is never held today.
Right. And very few people pay attention before Labor Day.
And even well into October.
Right.
We're going to see some of this shifting. And you know, the Quinnipiac numbers in Ohio and Florida, where this election is really being fought, along with North Carolina and Virginia, four states are basically the battlegrounds, a few others, of course, to get to the numbers. But when we're talking about four states, and right now a six-point margin, anything can and will happen when the Koch brothers and Karl Rove dump in, you know, $200-400 million in that last 6-week period when people are paying attention. No one should be sanguine about this at all.
And that's more, by the way, I always have to remind people, this is a country that elected George W. Bush 1.5 times. There's no reason we can assume that they would never elect Mitt Romney.
And not at all. And if you go back to one of the worst Republican tickets in modern times, McCain Palin.
Right.
At a time when no one wanted to vote for a Republican, they still got 170 plus electoral votes. I think it was 173. The census has now added 6. So if you start with that as the floor, with those numbers that McCain and Palin could get, being what Romney has, he is less than 100 electoral votes from being president. It will be close either way.
Absolutely.
But to say it's not going to happen is ridiculous. One other quick thing before I get Alec Baldwin here. The Senate, Carl, you and I watched this and have looked at what the Senate has done. Today they filibustered President Obama's cybersecurity bill. They're filibustering everything. They don't actually have to filibuster because they don't require people coming to the floor.
They've filibustered more than any Senate in history.
In history, and frankly, in the last year or two, probably more than any in the last 50 years
right.
combined. What we are seeing, however, is a Senate that is about to come in, whether I can hardly bring myself to say this aloud, this should be illegal by TSA rules, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, should that happen, is going to be presiding over the most conservative Republican majority in the Senate since maybe Franklin Roosevelt's second term. And we're going to be seeing the kinds of people like Ted Cruz, who won his primary. We're going to see Richard Murdoch, who upset
Kruger. Yeah, in Indiana.
These folks are going to make the Tea Party Republicans in the House. They're going to make Michelle Bachmann look moderate. and that's, you know, and the problem with this is...
And usually that's Marcus's job by picking the right pantsuit.
That's true. I would say God save the Queen, but the Olympics are going on. Oh, by the way, happy birthday to Dexter Von Frisch.
Absolutely. And I want to, you know, speaking of plugs, I want to plug this book that you, this recent release from... Kirk Douglas that you worked on.
I was the research editor on a book I'm extremely proud of. Kirk Douglas wrote his 10th book. He is 95 years old. I did the research and was able to help him find some of what he had written 50 and 60 years ago about the decision to break the blacklist.
Right.
Hired Dalton Trumbo, first time a blacklisted writer in the McCarthy era had ever had his name, his real name back on the screen, was Spartacus. The book is I Am Spartacus by Kirk Douglas, and it's one of the proudest things I've ever worked on in my life, including what you and I shared, which was the Howard Dean campaign, another proud moment.
Absolutely.
But this book tells that story, and the only thing I'll point out is that if you think it can't happen again, if you think you can't have people like Joe McCarthy waving lists of potential communists,
yeah, talk to Huma Abedin
down in Florida.
Right, or Alan West, absolutely. We may look at them as crazy, but the fact that our crazy uncles bring them up at Thanksgiving, that should be enough to know that they have sway over some people in this country.
I boycott Thanksgiving like I boycott Chick-fil-A.
That Chick-fil-A thing. I tell you what, seeing Sarah Palin and all these other Republicans chowing down on it has been quite a spectacle. Meanwhile, Democrats are trying to create jobs.
And there will be plenty of jobs at McDonald's and Chick-fil-A's under Mitt Romney's plan, where those are good American jobs. Carl, I know time is short, and I see the door getting ready to close, but let me say one thing about this Chick-fil-A business, because I've given it a lot of thought. You've seen that there's been disagreement. Mayor Bloomberg saying it's not government's business, other mayors saying we don't want Chick-fil-A in our town. Here's what I think. Tomorrow, in the reverse of Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day yesterday, tomorrow there's going to be, I believe, a kitchen going on at Chick-fil-A's. Gay people are going to show up and show their affection for each other and, for some reason, that chicken. Whether that's a smart idea, I don't know. I'm not going to weigh in on that. But what I do know is that if people who are openly gay and not disruptive, polite, and then get in line and try and buy chicken and are refused service, that is not free speech. That is discrimination.
Well, I would point out 15 years ago, similar uproar about Cracker Barrel, and that uproar did not immediately result in Cracker Barrel changing its policies, but here we are 15 years later. 2 years ago, Cracker Barrel changed its policies and now supports gay equality. So these things do have the ability to change hearts and minds. The other thing I'd point out is that from now on, Chick-fil-A will be, you know, tarred and feathered, so to speak, with, you know, this record. People will know about this. You've already seen its corporate index of approval ratings just plummet as a result of this controversy.
I would like to tar and pluck those feathers, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to have the flight attendants take your phone. I know you enjoy the Angry Birds as much as anybody else on the flights.
I'm playing Words with Alec Baldwin.
Words with Friends. Couldn't have enjoyed chatting with anybody else more. David Bender, thanks for joining us.
Carl, always your pleasure. Take care.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Two things in life are certain: taxes and Mitt Romney is really boring. In the summertime, filling in for Tom Hartman, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter, Carl Frisch. That's at KARLFRISCH. We've been asking you this afternoon, why don't you think Mitt Romney will release more of his taxes? He's only released a year, and it wasn't even his full tax return. You can let us know. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-8466, or answer the question on Facebook. We've got a poll going. Facebook.com/Carl Frisch. Here are the results thus far. In first place, he didn't pay taxes for a number of years, despite making buckets of money. Number two, the cost of revealing his tax evasion is greater than the cost of hiding it. Number three, He has so much hidden in Swiss bank accounts that they named an army knife after him. Number four, he has much to hide. Number five, sociopathic wealth hoarders have no use for the thoughts of the rabble. Number five, it's just not done, upper-class horse chortle. And many more other examples. You can either answer one of the options given or submit your own. And we've got some calls to that effect. Let's talk to Cora in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Cora, how are you?
Well, hi, Carl. Yeah, I was going to mention the dressage horse, too, and the $77,000 deduction. But, you know, with Romney hiding all this stuff and as the speculation is so wild about what it is, you know, it has to be pretty bad. And I also have to wonder if Sheldon Adelson doesn't know something about this, because I have a hard time believing that Sheldon Adelson and Mitt Romney would trust each other.
Well,
I mean, why
you think that, though, is because to you, $10 million is a lot of money, right?
Well, there you go.
To Sheldon Adelson, that, the difference, that's like $75 to you or $25 to you in terms of his wealth. So when he spends $15, $20 million, it's like it's really like us spending $25.
I know, it's like a drop in the bucket. I still have a hard time believing that he would trust Mitt to do what he wants him to do once he's president, is what I'm wondering.
Oh, sure. So. Well, it's an interesting predicament that Romney's in, because everybody within his party wants him to go to war with Ron, and that's precisely what Sheldon wants. So that's why he's in this thing. I do have it on good authority. I can neither confirm nor deny nor say whether or not I just made this up. That the reason Mitt Romney will not be releasing his taxes anytime soon is because he's given a lot of money to the Muslim Brotherhood. I heard that from somebody that may or may not have been Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah,
so,
well, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, you got to play both sides, and you know that
right.
way you're the winner or whatever.
It could be literally anything. We want to know what you think it is. Vote online, Facebook.com/Carl Frisch. Let's see here. Let's talk to Edward in Clarkson, Michigan. Hey, Edward.
How you doing, Carl?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, it's great. You were talking about the Olympic medals and the taxation
right.
on Olympic medals. Was that just the medals they were talking about?
Yeah, they were talking about the people that win the gold medal, the silver medal, the bronze medal.
Yeah, the gold medal, they haven't been solid gold since, like, 1912.
Oh, wait, don't bring your facts into this equation.
the gold medal is actually, I guess it's like silver, with a gold plating. And it's worth, I looked it up, $644. Silver medal, $330. Bronze medal, $4.70.
So. Well, apparently it's cash and the medal. So the big problem here is that the assumption by the Americans for tax reform that all of these athletes are wealthy. And first of all, if they are wealthy and paying the tax bracket that the ATR thinks they are, they can afford to pay the taxes on this stuff. And second of all, that they would never have anything to write off on their taxes as a business expense related to their work as an athlete. Look at the Romneys. They don't even, to use their phraseology, they are not even in sport, but they have a horse in sport and still manage to write off $77,000 in tax write-offs based on Rafalka's performance as a prancing, dancing, pretty little pony. And remember, this is a horse that has had the help and assistance of very experienced, very thoughtful, practical sports psychologists. I always thought growing up that my desert tortoise was a little depressed and maybe he could have used a psychologist, but my folks just didn't have the coverage for him. So I guess that's just another indication that you have a lot of money when you can get a shrink for your horse. Let's see here. Let's go to Mo in New York City. Hey, Mo.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. People haven't spoken. They spoke about the purpose of eliminating tax cuts is to gain revenue. Now, they don't mention numbers. Now, for example, if the taxes for the people under $250,000,
mm-hmm.
Who were making that, were if that cut was removed, how much money revenue would come in? And if the tax cut for people over $50,000 was removed, how much money would come in to the government?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Well, the point is, they talk about eliminating tax cuts, and they were saying, let's eliminate them. The Democrats, I think, want to eliminate them for people who are making less than $50,000 a year.
No, that's not true. Democrats want to eliminate the tax cuts for people making over $250,000 a year. They don't want to raise taxes on. They don't want to raise taxes on working poor people and middle class people.
That's right. They want to eliminate the tax cuts for people under $250,000. Right? Is that right?
No, you've got it backwards. They want to eliminate the tax cuts for people making over a certain amount.
The question is, though, if you do that, how much money would come in for the people if you eliminate the tax cut for people making over $250,000, and how much would come in annually for the if you eliminate the tax cuts for the people?
Well, here's the problem. If you eliminate the taxes on people, if you get rid of the tax relief that you've given to the middle class, what ends up happening is they stop spending money. One of the reasons the economy has been sluggish to recover is that middle-class folks who were hurt hardest by this economy have held on to more of their money and have paid down their debt. That's probably good, wise spending habits by Americans for the first time in a long time, but it doesn't help the economy. Americans in the middle class need money so that they can invest in the economy by buying things and investing in things. The wealthy just hoard the money, and they've not contributed anything, even though they've done so good. This is the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today and tomorrow. I'm Carl Frisch, Democratic strategist, syndicated columnist. I am a partner at Bullfight Strategies here in Washington, D.C. More about me at carlfrisch.com. And as always, you can vote in our online poll about why is Mitt Romney hiding his tax returns. Go to facebook.com/Carl Frisch and let us know why you think he is. This hour, we're going to take a little departure from the norm and talk a little bit about the technology that is fueling the 2012 campaign. There's a lot of new stuff out there, and from cycle to cycle, we hear more and more about the advances in technology. 2008 was all about how Obama revolutionized the use of technology. This campaign is going to be one that is won online, and I couldn't have thought of anybody better to talk about these issues, from maybe a 30,000-foot level than Nancy Scola. She is a political writer for The Atlantic. You can find her work at Nancy Scola, SCOLA.com. You can also find her on Twitter at Nancy Scola. It's going to be interesting. Let's find out what she thinks is happening with the Romney and Obama campaigns when it comes to online. Nancy, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So, in 2008, it was Obama, Obama, Obama when it comes to online. Obviously, Republicans have had some time to catch up over the last 4 years. Where do you think things stand today when it comes to the online operations of the DNC, the RNC, Obama, and Romney?
I think they're sort of on a more level playing field than things were in 2008. Certainly the McCain campaign made some initial forays onto the web, but didn't do a very good job sort of building out their operations. I think the Romney campaign has gone about it a little bit differently than the Obama campaign has. But has still put a lot of effort into making sure that they cover their bases. So they have surrogates on Twitter the same way the Obama campaign does. They've been out the door with some early apps the same way the Obama campaign does.
They've had some stumbles along the way, too. They've had some stumbles with their mobile apps along the way. One thing comes to mind is that I'm with Mitt application for the iPhone that superimposed images on things and they misspelled America.
They sure did. That was unfortunate from their perspective. They did, and it's interesting. They've sort of taken it a little bit more slowly than the Obama campaign has, in that they do these very sort of small bore apps. So they did the I'm with Mitt app where you could take a picture of yourself and sort of superimpose, as you said, some slogans, some pro-Romney slogans. And it's sort of an acknowledgement that they don't have the staff that the Obama campaign does. They have ramped up since the nomination was sort of secured. But if you look at the Obama campaign's digital operation, it looks like a mid-sized company of hundreds of people. Where the Romney campaign has sort of acknowledged, especially during the primaries, that they were, eight folks in a room and there was a limited amount that they could do.
Well, it's ironic. I mean, looking at 2008 at least, that the McCain campaign would be in the position it found itself in, being swamped by Obama online. I mean, if you remember back in 2000, confession to make, I was a Republican in 2000 working for McCain.
Yeah.
McCain was the guy that was revolutionizing online in 2000.
Absolutely, especially some of the infrastructural things, so that matching the voter data so that you could go out and actually target folks and know a little bit about them before you did. That's something that the Obama campaign really ran with in 2008, have really sort of focused on in 2012. And we kind of, some of that we don't know the extent to. The Romney campaign has actually done that, right? Because we haven't focused so much on the sort of like GOTV voter contact stuff very publicly. So we don't know how well their operation is going to run when you actually get to the point of really kind of dragging in voters.
Well, and they've obviously, both sides have been spending millions and millions of dollars on their online and social media operations. I read a piece, I think it was in Mashable this week, that talked about the new mobile apps from the Obama campaign and from the Romney campaign. Obama's team having this fairly sophisticated canvassing application. You know, people can find the app on iTunes and I believe, you know, in the Android store as well, where they can actually just log in and find voters in their neighborhood that the Obama team wants them to walk to or call with scripts and everything else, and then they plug in the information when they're done, and it goes right back to the Obama campaign.
It's fairly remarkable. I actually just was playing with the app a few minutes ago, and you can pull up the people in your neighborhood, and it gives you their voter registration, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or something else, and their age and their gender, which is sort of a neat thing, especially living in a city. You can kind of see who you're surrounded by.
Right. My neighbors are Republican.
Yeah, exactly, and which raises sort of a lot of interesting questions about privacy. I mean, that data's been out there, but as sort of when they target it on a Google map, it becomes a whole new thing.
Well, I remember a time, I mean, maybe we've just gotten away from having, you know, volunteer time to stuff envelopes with maps and walk sheets, but that kind of information has been public since there's been voter registration.
It's been public in the way that it's public for sure by definition, but, you know, there was a time that you had to actually go into a campaign office, sit down with the pieces of paper that have been highlighted with your walk route. I mean, it's a bit different if anyone now can actually download the app and walk out your door and start knocking on your neighbor's houses. The interesting thing is, I think from the Obama perspective and from the perspective of people who have followed campaign tech, is one of the things they seem to be actually sort of figuring out this cycle is how to marry the online and offline work that volunteers do.
Which has really been the push over the last several years, is how do you do that?
Yeah, and if you talk to campaign folks sort of, you know, after hours, they will say that there was a little bit more talk about being successful at that than there was practice. So if they wanted to get people involved on the internet in the Obama campaign, but that stuff wasn't really being fed back into their databases that were really sort of like the meat of the campaign. So some of that effort was lost. I mean, they never told volunteers that, but it wasn't sort of valued in the same way as, you know, we know a lot about you and we can, you know, we send you from campaign headquarters or the local office to do some work for us, and we count that sort of very strenuously. So what they're doing now with their new tools is, if you volunteer online, go knocking in your neighborhood, it counts the same way if you're doing it via an app or via paper that you picked up in the local office. So that's a bit of a switch, and it's sort of the one way I think the internet has sort of like gained ground in this election is there. I think in a lot of other ways, sort of, we've sort of kind of gone backwards.
Well, and the good thing, you know, at least from a campaign staffer's point of view, is that when somebody walks door to door using the app and they enter in the information of the results from their conversations with voters, that stuff automatically goes back to, you know, the van system at the Obama headquarters, so that those people aren't being approached over and over and over again. There's not a lot of duplication of efforts going on as a result.
Absolutely. And if you're a campaign official, you get those sort of instantaneous results. You can imagine how appealing that is for somebody who's sort of running a campaign to get constant updates.
It's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm not in field anymore. I was a field director. I think the last time I worked in field was 2001, my first Democratic campaign. I would have been sitting in front of that monitor pressing the refresh button all day long just to see how things were going.
There's no cycle. I mean, in 2008, we talked about the idea that the news cycle is now a few minutes long, a few seconds long. There's actually absolutely no break now with the flow of information that you get. There's not even, there's no cycle to be supposed, you know.
Well, and depending on what you're sending people out to ask them to do, you don't have to just ask them to, you know, sign up, you know, people to say, yes, I'm going to vote for you. You can ask, I mean, this is technology that can be used by all kinds of different causes. you could ask people for donations, put yard signs. You could ask people if they've heard about a story about your opponent. You could get all kinds of good intel from the field.
Absolutely. And one of the things you would hope is that it actually increases the sort of information content of some of these interactions. Or if somebody, you know, if you've ever had the experience of somebody canvassing, knocking on your door, and you ask them a question about their cause or campaign and they don't really know, the hope is with this app, you open it up and it tells you. I mean, you can scroll through, okay, what is the president's, you know, policies on
right.
Iran or, you know, some sort of small facet of healthcare or whatever it is. But the hope would be that it actually sort of prepares the volunteer to do a better job of speaking on the issues.
Well, if you had to say now who you thought had the upper hand online, I mean, yes, we look at social media and the president's got, you know, tens of millions of people following him on Facebook and Twitter to Romney's, you know, probably in the low millions if he's there yet. Who do you think has the upper leg when it comes to technology and what's that impact going to be in November?
Yeah,
really
I mean,
quick.
I hate to say that the answer is that we don't necessarily know. I think the Obama campaign has invested more in it. We'll see if whether the return on that investment is worthwhile.
Nancy Scola from The Atlantic. You can find her at nancyscola.com. Nancy, thanks for joining me and shedding some light on what's happening in 2012 online. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, we're talking to Stu Trevelyan from NGP Van about some really interesting new technology involving Facebook.
Nobody knows it but me when I sip. Yeah, I sip, I'm still.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. If you're just joining us, we are talking this hour about political technology, what's being done in 2012 to sway the election. We just chatted with Nancy Scola from The Atlantic about the Romney and Obama campaigns and what they're up to and who has the edge. Joining me now to talk about a new product that's out there. You might call it the product Fox News doesn't want Democrats using, is the president and CEO of NGP Van. You can find them at ngpvan.com. Stuart Trevelyan, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Carl.
So people have been talking for quite a long time about the ability to sway people using social media online. There really hasn't been, and you know, this is something we've been working with together on, there really hasn't been something out there that was quantifiable. I mean, you could get more likes on your page, more followers on Twitter, but there really wasn't a good way of engaging people for direct political action that a campaign would typically take, whether it's voter identification, whether it's you know, recruiting people to attend a rally or grassroots fundraising efforts. And then along comes NGP Van's social organizing tool, which people can find at ngpvan.com/social-organizing. Tell us about the tool and what it does.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that people know is that in politics is a personal contact from people that voters know is the most effective way to get those voters to do what you want, whether that be vote the right way, get out to vote, give money, volunteer. And there really hasn't been a great way to do that at scale and with sophistication. There's, you know, also sort of a general problem that's happening with campaigns where TV ads are less effective than
right.
they used to be. People are getting rid of their home phones. And so the traditional ways of reaching people are less effective. And so now what we're able to do is we're able to use a social graph from Facebook using their APIs, to be technical for a second. That opens up a wealth of data so that a supporter for a campaign can go onto a website and log into this tool using Facebook, and then they can have their Facebook friends match to the voter file, and then the campaign can identify different universes, you know, the particular people with profile that might be good to ask to volunteer.
So if I'm running for Congress, let's say in Colorado,
sure.
and I have a website up and I'm using the social organizing tool, and I email my supporters because I want them to help identify voters in my district. They would then, my supporters would then come to the website, log in with their Facebook account, and then match their friends that might live in the district, and be given like a script to help them identify friends that are on Facebook that match the voter file that we want to identify as voters.
Yeah, that's right. And then they can be given tasks, you know, identifying different target universes so they can it can be identified for them. Ask these friends to come volunteer. Ask these friends to donate. These particular friends look like persuadable voters who are currently undecided. Here's a script for you to try and persuade them. And then all the information about that activity that supporters do goes right back directly into the VAN, which is the voter interaction product that almost every Democratic candidate and progressive organization uses.
Well, and I want to stress that point. I mean, I was going to say it's a pretty powerful tool when it comes to, you know, involving your supporters and their friends in the campaign. And if people out there know of a Democratic campaign or progressive organization that should be using it, they should go to ngbvan.com/social-organizing and check it out. And I specifically say Democrats and progressives because that matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, NGPVAN is a mission-based organization, so our mission is to provide Democrats and progressives with the technology advantage. You know, obviously we could make more money if we sold our products both to Republicans and Democrats, but that would make us an arms dealer. And you know, what we really want to do is we want to help elect Democrats because we believe in candidates who are pro-women, pro-worker, et cetera.
Well, you know, the money that candidates spend with consultants ends up going back into the development of better tools to get a better advantage against Republicans, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, a lot of our ideas actually have come from Democrats and progressives who have been using our tools. In fact, the idea for social organizing came out of our work with We Are Ohio, which was the ballot initiative in Ohio where the unions were trying to protect their rights to collectively bargain. And that's exactly right, Carl. You know, when Democrats and progressives have those ideas and give them to companies that only provide tools to Democrats and progressives, they make sure that those ideas are only used for their allies and not by people who are trying to defeat them.
Well, it's a remarkable tool. People can check it out. Like I said, ngbvan.com/social-organizing. I talked a bit with Nancy Scola about these mobile apps that the Romney campaign and Obama campaign had featured in Mashable this week, and my understanding is that NGPVAN's canvassing tools, or the canvassing tools in the Obama application, were developed in partnership with NGPVAN.
Yeah, that's right. Our mobile development team worked hand in glove with the Obama team to develop that portion of the app, and it's really exciting in that people now in the palm of their hand, you know, at times that are convenient for them, for as long as it's convenient for them, can canvass people in their neighborhood, and they can have the information that helps them do that. So they can see who the right voters are to be talking to. They can see, you know, what party those people are registered with, and they can have a script provided by the Obama campaign that asks the right questions. And then the information they collect there at the doorstep goes directly back to the Obama campaign. So it makes sure that the Obama campaign is tightly integrated with these people who want to support them.
These tools are absolutely amazing. I'd ask you in jest if you thought 10 years ago we'd be this far technologically, but it's just insane. Stu Trevelyan, the CEO of NGPVAN. You can find them at ngpvan.com. Stu, thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Carl.
Absolutely. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, I have a confession about my former life as a Republican.
But can you go back once you know?
You don't know me.
You don't know me at all.
You don't know me.
You don't know me at all.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom this afternoon, I am Carl Frisch, Democratic strategist, and you might not know this about me. I have a confession to make. For a time in my youth, I experimented with being a Republican. And the last Republican that I worked for was John McCain in 2000 on his presidential campaign. And I was a fairly young guy. I think I was about 21 or 22 years old. Might have turned 22 during the campaign. And as a result, and since I knew basic HTML code. We've been talking about political technology during this campaign. One of my tasks as a press advance and field advance guy for the campaign was keeping various sections of what we called the McCain Interactive website up to date. Basically what it was a bunch of websites dedicated to what was happening in each campaign or for the campaign in each state. Not too sophisticated compared to today's standards, but back then it was cutting edge. And back then it was the McCain campaign that was breaking barriers when it came to online. And I thought it would be interesting to chat about where we've been and where we've come since then with Max Foss. He is the former webmaster for McCain 2000, and now he is the CEO of IWS Integrated Web Solutions, which provides political technology, websites, tools, et cetera, for Republican candidates. We worked together on the McCain 2000 campaign. And since I worked for Dean in 2004 and we've seen Obama 2008, I thought it'd be an interesting conversation to see just how far we've come. Joining me now, Max Foss, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
I'm doing good. Long time no talk.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
It's only been about 12 years. Now, it's been 12 long years since the McCain campaign burst onto the scene after the New Hampshire primary by raising, I can't remember if it was $1 or $2 million over the course of 48 hours, which everybody thought was like the most amazing thing in the world.
Yeah, it was $1 million in 48 hours, so $500,000 a day, which at the time was unheard of.
Right. I mean, we barely knew that people would even be willing to give money online back then. I mean, people were barely buying things online.
Right. It was amazing to watch, and, you know, I think obviously you've seen 4 years out with what happened with Howard Dean, and then 8 years out with President Obama was able to do online.
I mean, it used to be, let me just ask you this. When you went into business after the McCain campaign to offer web solutions for Republican causes and candidates, I imagine it was a pretty difficult sales pitch for a lot of people to get them to dedicate resources to this part of politics, because everybody else, you know, you're entrenched with your mail people and your TV people and your field people and your political people, and just a lot of places are very slow to change.
It was hard. I mean, everybody wanted to do, you know, what John McCain did in the presidential race, you know, 12 years ago. But nobody wanted to, like you said, dedicate the resources or even knew what the resources were to dedicate. You know, and I remember a meeting about a month before New Hampshire where we actually made the decision to dedicate to buy 6 more servers. And it was a big decision inside the campaign. But it worked. And, you know, it's a good thing we had it because, you know, a couple of the servers went offline. We had backups, but it was about a $60,000 decision at the time when the campaign didn't have that money, but it was the right decision. And to get people to do that, you know, 10 years ago, it was hard to convince them. Nowadays, it's not. You see a whole campaign division on the presidential dedicated to online.
Well, I mean, we used to say, at least during the Dean campaign, early on, if the website went down because of traffic, it was like, oh, we're so popular that the website crashed.
Right.
And, you know, what reporters didn't know how to follow up that answer with the appropriate question is, how much money are you losing and signups are you losing as a result of your website being down right now?
Right. It's, you know, it's like if you owned a shoe store and the website went down for a day, you know, you would fire somebody.
Exactly.
Same in politics.
So what's been the biggest surprise for you? You know, having worked for McCain in 2000 and really been at the ground floor of this political technology and you know, web presence space, what's been the biggest surprise to you over this last decade in terms of the innovation?
Well, I think the innovation hasn't been the surprise, but I think going back to what Lynn Reed, who did the Bradley campaign during that time, always used to say is that content is king.
Mm-hmm.
And as you've moved 12 years away from there, you know, emails, you know, the matching of voter email addresses has exploded. Social media has exploded. The tools, you know, the apps and mobile has exploded. But I think it all comes back to, and people forget this, that the content really, you know, drives everything. And the technology is just an avenue for the activism.
Absolutely.
But really the content's going to get people there and get people involved.
Yeah, I can't imagine how many people after 2008 said, oh, we need to have an Obama-style, like, Facebook tool. What they were forgetting is that their client wasn't Obama.
Exactly. And the same thing happened to McCain after the first round. you know, everyone wanted to be that candidate, but they're, you know, they didn't have the content, and that content can be the candidate, but, you know, it needs to have that energy. And I think you're seeing some of that lack of that this time with the president's campaign, is that that energy that he had 4 years ago just probably isn't there. I'm not saying it's not going to be there, but it's not there right now.
Well, and if we accept that as true, certainly tools and technology have advanced to a degree that might make up the difference there. I was just talking to Stu Trevelyan from NGP Van about their social organizing tool, and I talked to Nancy Scola about the new apps out by the mobile apps out by the Romney and Obama camp. And the new Obama iPhone app, or, you know, mobile app, allows people to log in and immediately canvass their neighborhood with, you know, pre-written scripts, and it connects directly to the database at OFA headquarters in Chicago. So when you knock on your neighbor's door and get an answer from them, the information you log in goes directly into the voter file at Obama headquarters, which is, you know, I guess the days of stuffing envelopes and stapling maps to the front of an envelope are dead.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, you can send people out with an iPad. They could be walking door to door. They could show a campaign video on any issue that the campaign's produced. And then again, like you said, track it in real time back to the campaign. You know, it's the databases and the way they're integrated into campaigns are great now. It's exciting. It's exciting.
Well, and for voters, it means something that I think they may not have ever thought would happen. It may cut down on the number of phone calls they get and the number of door knocks they get after somebody's already been identified. I mean, how many times have you heard of volunteers coming back into the, say, the campaign office and saying, this person said that they got 6 calls in the last week? Now that this stuff is all integrated, that stuff can be easily cut down quite a bit.
Yeah, you can save money. It's always saved campaigns money. Be interesting to see if voters would actually self-select the way they wanted to receive information.
know, right.
You could get it to that level. But,
well, I think there's a reason that politicians have always exempted the political process from the ability to opt out of mailings and 800 numbers and everything else.
Right.
They want to be able to have easy access to contacting voters. I'm curious, you know, one of the things that we noticed during the Dean campaign, when Dean was kind of surging and blogging was really taking off, obviously the Bush administration was a good foil for the Dean era through Obama, right? It kind of grew this community automatically out there. Howard Dean happened to be there with the right message for that group. And one of the things that we noticed at the time was that the structure, Republicans and Democrats are similar in that they're both political parties. The structures within the parties are different in that Republicans tend to be a little bit more top-down from the consulting class in terms of how that type of stuff works. You know, in my experience back when I was doing some web consulting following McCain right before I switched parties, there were very few companies that were allowed in the room to talk about doing websites. I mean, it was still the struggle to get people to stop doing brochures on the web and start doing something more interesting like McCain had done.
Right.
And on the left, it was like, we want to blow the roof off. Let's make this work. Let's do whatever it takes to get this done. And it feels like Republicans were a little slower to pick that up until Obama got into office. Is it about having that foil to harness the power from, or is it a cultural thing?
I think at first it was a cultural thing in the early 2000s, but I think Republicans saw the tool that was being used on the, you know, like the Act Blue, and the Republicans,
right,
you know, sought to duplicate things like that. And so they were slower to get there, but I think they have gotten there. And I think they've done a better job with the database and the back end part of it. Maybe not the social part, you know, per se, but definitely with the back end databases, which I think they've always been better at in the targeting. You know, and I think the internet and online, you know, is more tailor-made for an insurgent type campaign.
Sure.
And
certainly something that
Howard Dean and McCain and even, you know, Obama in 08.
Well, and how much do you think that's changed things fundamentally forever? The fact that somebody like Obama could take on the Clintons, you know, the fact that any number of these Republican candidates that ran against Mitt Romney this time around had their moment in the sun. I mean, my opinion on why they never were able to take off or, you know, fight back the attacks was that most of the good campaign teams were pretty much snatched up in this election cycle by Romney or stayed dry, you know, kept their powder dry. So when, say, a Rick Santorum or a Newt Gingrich would hit their stride and then, you know, Romney's professional team would hit them back, they didn't have a way of responding. Is it only a matter of time before somebody who is not necessarily as charismatic as Obama but is right on the issues, the dark horse candidate, has the money to actually fight and win, say somebody like Bradley, somebody like McCain 2000, somebody like, you know, a Newt Gingrich or another Republican candidate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's at a tipping point. And the Internet, I think, you know, you name, you know, let's compare McCain and Howard Dean. You know, they both were almost there, but it wasn't enough to put them over.
Well, and maybe we'll see that in four more years in the next open race.
Yeah,
thanks a lot, Max. Max Fost from IWS. You can get his website online, workwithiws.com. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Ever wonder why when you're looking at shoes online, you start seeing ads for shoes on every website you go to? We'll tell you why after this break. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon, today and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch, Democratic strategist, syndicated columnist, fun guy all around. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. There's this great piece I read in Politico today. We've been talking about political technology this afternoon. The headline of the piece is, for online video ads, act before space runs out. That's right. People are actually running out of space online to advertise for politics. Joining me now to talk about some new technology that has kind of revolutionized the way that people are advertising for campaigns online is my good friend Chris Massicott. He is a progressive activist. He's also one of the partners of a firm called DS Political. You can find them at dspolitical.com. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Carl. How are you?
I'm good. So they're running out of space for these online videos from campaigns to buy space. What's going on?
Well, as you can probably imagine, you know, there's only a limited number of pre-roll video advertising that is going to be available during the crunch time of elections. You know,
so when you say pre-roll video, what do you mean by that?
You know, that what I used to think was an annoying little piece of 15 or 30 second video you had to watch before you got to see your MSNBC clip or Rachel Maddow or
yeah.
something. That's considered pre-roll video, and that's what we are using to advertise online.
Well, before I came to this segment, I talked about how I was going to tell people why when they're online and they're looking to buy a new pair of New Balances for the gym or whatever, they start seeing ads for shoes on every website they go to. Your company, DS Political, again, people can find it online at DS Political. You can also follow Chris Massicott on Twitter at Chris Massicott. That's Massicotte. Your firm has kind of explained it in political terms that I'll understand why that happens. Why does it happen?
Certainly. So when you go to a website like you were saying to shop for a new car or a parachute, you get your browser gets what we call cookie. There's a cookie on your browser. It's a tiny line of code that understands that you've been to this website, that gives you a little bit more information, seller information about you and what kinds of things you'd like to see. So essentially they're advertising to you again because it's more likely that you're going to come back to that website and then make that purchase if you're reminded of it over and over again that, hey, remember when you were looking at these shoes? And lots of corporate companies have been doing this successfully for a number of years now. And it's just recently that the political space and really the progressive political space has really gotten into this.
So DSPolitical.com or DS Political, your company, is a progressive Democratic company, works only with progressives and Democrats,
correct.
Was founded by only progressives and Democrats, is funded by only progressives and Democrats, and you have what you call the political cookie. What does that mean?
So you're running a political campaign, and there's only, you know, there's one thing you can't get more of in a political campaign is time, and apparently now advertising space, but let's go with time first. And you don't have time to wait for every person that you want to talk to go to your website so that you can cookie them to have, send ads to them over that period of time during the campaign. So what we've done is we've collected a browser cookie pool of about 400 million third-party browser cookies, meaning we acquired them from various sources and aggregated them together.
Just like a company might do that.
Exactly, exactly. There are many marketers that do this to find out more about what, you know, the people that they want to tell, you know, send messages to, that actually want to hear that. So then we take that information and we match that to the voter file. And when we do that, we anonymize the cookies. So we, you know, we're not really invading your privacy that much. We just know that the person most likely looking at that web browser is a registered male between the ages of 18 and 30. That's a registered Democrat that votes in primary. That's somebody that we want to talk to.
And maybe happens to live in a certain area.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Exactly.
So basically what you're saying is, if a campaign has like $15,000 to spend in online advertising, they no longer have to advertise, let's say, on Huffington Post and cross their fingers that the right number of progressives from their district will go and see their ads. They can actually say, okay, according to my pollster and according to the work we've done in the field, I need to target these voters in my district, and then you all can actually serve advertising for that candidate to those voters on the websites that those voters visit.
That's exactly right. So DSP stands for Demand Side Platform. That's where the DSP and DSP, DS Political comes from. And what that is, it's an ad exchange. So that we purchase advertising inventory from about 22,000 different websites so that you don't have to worry about which website is coming and which, what people are advertising on. So then when you, you know, purchase advertising space through us, you're not advertising on a website. You're advertising to a cookie to somebody who we know we want to send that message to.
So if you're the Sierra Club, and mm-hmm. you're doing some you know activity to let people know that Congressman so and so has been horrible for the environment, you can then buy advertising targeting voters, specific voters, in the district of Congressman so and so.
Absolutely. So, for example, let's use that district of Congressman so-and-so. Let's be even more fun and say in the district of Michelle Bachmann. And there are, you know, there's somebody running against her that has utilized, you know, online ads before. And, you know, we can then go and say, hey, we have a model using Catalyst data. Catalyst is a progressive data firm that is one of the most well-respected data firms out there, and we work with them exclusively on this stuff. They have models of people who are most likely to respond to an environmental or some kind of ad, and we've matched our cookies to that particular model, and then we can advertise to those folks that are most likely to be energized and you know take action when they see that particular.
Chris, I got to tell you, it's absolutely fascinating. We've got to cut it there. That's Chris Mascott. He is a partner at DS Political. You can find them at dspolitical.com. Amazing how far technology has come in 2012 for this election. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in, I'm Carl Frisch. In the next hour, we're going to be talking to Cal Penn, the actor and Obama supporter. In addition, we're also going to be talking to John Ward from Huffington Post. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom this afternoon and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. A headline at Huffington Post caught my eye dealing with Mr. Romney. The headline being, Mitt Romney promises millions of jobs but offers no data to back it up. And it's an interesting read. I encourage you to go to Huffington Post and read it. Here's one of the opening paragraphs that I thought would be interesting to talk about. The Romney campaign is not engaging on the same playing field as Obama. When asked Thursday in a conference call how much Romney's plan might add to the deficit before the economic growth it projected to create was factored in, along with closing loopholes and cutting spending, the campaign declined to offer specific numbers. In a sense, the Romney campaign is handicapping itself because Obama is now out there on a campaign trail wielding specific numbers against Romney, whacking him over the head with lines like this, quote, the average middle-class family with children, according to this study, would be hit with a tax increase of $2,000. In order to afford just one $250,000 tax cut for somebody like Mr. Romney, 125 families like yours would have to pay another $2,000 in taxes each year, Obama told a crowd in Mansfield, Ohio. So who do we get to talk about this story? None other than John Ward, the man who wrote it, a senior political reporter for Huffington Post. John, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Carl. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. So, you know, where is the beef? Mitt Romney's out there on the campaign trail. I imagine it's difficult to get these types of specific answers out of a candidate who so rarely avails himself to the media.
It is. And I, quite frankly, was a little disappointed with the questions that were asked on the conference call. You know, the campaign threw out some other, I guess, fact. They weren't really factoids. They were remarks, and other reporters followed up on that. And I love my colleagues in the media, but it was a conference call where we did have a policy advisor on there, and I think it was an opportunity to kind of drill down on some of these issues, and we didn't. My understanding is that the Romney campaign will be putting out some more details and numbers. We'll see what that includes. But I think the point of all this is that much like a lot of their campaign, and I think you could put his trip to Europe kind of through view it through this same prism. The Romney campaign is really driven by a deep caution about taking too much attention away from President Obama. And the biggest way they feel like they will do that is by saying anything other than he has not done a good job on the economy. But what they're doing is offering sort of a blank canvas to the Democratic campaign, the Obama campaign. And the Democrats are filling that in. Or as, you know, in the case of the Europe trip, he doesn't go over there and give any policy specifics, and so his gaffes kind of become the story. So in this
case, I guess the same holds true with not releasing taxes, right? He doesn't release specifics, so the Obama campaign and folks out there who are concerned talk nothing but about what's in the taxes that haven't been released.
Right, thus comments like Harry Reid's. And so, you know, in this latest episode, I think you have another one of these circumstances where Obama's out there. He has a study that gives specific numbers. The study is somewhat speculative in terms of saying what Romney would have to do to meet projections, but Romney doesn't meet that speculation with his own sort of assertion of what he would do. And so, you know, he doesn't have any facts or figures to kind of come back at Romney, Obama and the Democrats with.
Well, and it seems to be a campaigning from a place of we're afraid of what they might say about us.
In what sense, I guess?
Well, I mean, if the whole argument is we're not putting out specific numbers because that'll give something for the Obama campaign to latch onto.
Right.
Well, that's not, you know, necessarily arguing from a place of I guess a better word, you know, power. You know, if you're not willing to say specifically what you're going to do, obviously the Obama team is going to say something. I mean, it was the argument they used against releasing more taxes, right? We're not going to put them out there because the Democrats might do something with it.
Right. It's not a campaign from a place of strength. That's correct. And that's a calculation they've made. I think if Romney loses, this will be the biggest reason why, is because he did not offer a very proactive campaign.
Well, and you'll hear lots of political professionals on both sides of the aisle through the years talk about, you know, people don't vote necessarily against somebody. They like to vote for somebody. Is it harder for somebody to vote for Mitt Romney when the message he's trying to offer is purely anti-Obama?
I think it depends on who that person is.
Sure.
And you know, the campaign, the Romney campaign's calculation is that there's enough people out there that are sick and tired, to this point at least, is that there's enough people that are sick and tired of the economy and the economic situation that they find themselves in, that they'll just go with choice B. We do have a little bit of time, left in this campaign. Obviously, we have 3 months. We'll see what happens at the convention and into the fall, And I think the VP pick will be a big signal as to whether or not they're going to change strategies. I don't see them changing strategies. I think that the highest likelihood is that we'll have somebody like Rob Portman or Tim Pawlenty. I think there's a lot of conservatives who are discouraged and frustrated with this process, this approach, who want to see people. I mean, there's a lot of conservatives that would love to see Paul Ryan
be the running mate because that
there are
would
a lot of liberals that would like to see Paul Ryan as the running mate.
Absolutely. Yeah, people on both sides. But they're, you know, the Romney campaign operatives, I'm sure there are some people in there who wouldn't mind seeing Paul Ryan, but I think most of the seasoned political operatives just feel like that would be suicide.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, if Obama is enemy number one of the Romney campaign, sometimes it feels like the media is enemy number two. And obviously, you've been a reporter for quite a while. You know, it's nothing new for you to be attacked by, you know, a candidate or a campaign. But I'm struck by how easy it's been for the Romney campaign to not engage with the media. I mean, at one point it had been so many months since Romney had appeared on a Sunday show that wasn't Fox News, and then you know, trying to shut the media out on his trip abroad, and his handler, you know, basically cursing out members of the media. Is there risk in doing that?
Yeah, I do think there is. I think it's driven in part by sort of this belief that's been percolating on both sides, you know, the Obama campaign and the Obama administration, when they took office, certainly shared this view that the mainstream press, the mainstream channels, whether you're talking about mainstream newspapers, the big newspapers or the big TV networks, were less powerful than before. And you have sort of a rise of partisan media and splintered, less cohesive media. But and so that kind of allows you to communicate more through the channels you want to communicate through. That's kind of the prevailing view. But I do think that when you go abroad and you don't do a good job of taking, for lack of a better phrase, taking care of in terms of giving meat or stories to people, to reporters where they're covering it with you, then that just kind of there is a perception of the candidate that's created through that coverage. That's harmful.
Well, and you know,
it's hard though to aggregate and kind of measure a lot of this stuff.
I'm sure. And you know, one of the things I think it's been a stock trade for Republicans over the last 40 years to always attack the media. The Romney campaign seems to do it because it helps them strengthen, you know, their leverage and support with the base, which really doesn't like Mitt Romney to begin with. At a certain point, I mean, we're coming up on him announcing his running mate. You mentioned that. Do you think he's going to use that as an opportunity, A, to get plenty of media attention from all the outlets that he kind of ignores, and to pivot that, you know, we're running out of time, but maybe you can give a yes or no. Is he going to use it as an opportunity to pivot back to Obama, and we're going to see some kind of an attack dog as his running mate?
Yeah, I mean, I think all those things are true. Bobby Jindal's an attack dog, but I don't necessarily see him as the nominee.
No, I think he's going to go back to his job as the NBC page on 30 Rock. John Ward, Huffington Post senior political reporter, thanks for joining me. This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be right back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up next, we're talking to Governor Don Seligman. Siegelman. Sorry.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch. And visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon, today and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch. Joining me next, you've probably heard the story of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, who, in my humble opinion, was wrongly put in jail for a trumped-up bribery charge. It's so outrageous were the charges that 52 states attorneys have pleaded with Congress over the years to you know, review the case. What it boils down to is nothing but politics. The governor was the only Democrat in Alabama that Republicans just couldn't get rid of. And Karl Rove and his henchmen set out to get rid of him in a different way that didn't involve the ballot box. And now, his attorney is appealing to the state to let him serve the remainder of his sentence doing community service, where he can put his remarkable talents to work for people who need it, rather than putting him in jail for 88 months. Just absolutely outrageous. Joining me to talk about this is none other than the former governor himself. Governor, how are you?
Hey, Carl, I'm doing great. I could actually maybe turn my fundraising talents to raise money for Free Speech TV, and that would be
a, that'd be an excellent thing to do.
That would be a benefit to society, and I do want to say thank you, not only to Tom Hartman and you, but to Free Speech TV for making this happen. We all need to have our voices heard, and unfortunately, a lot of times you can't get your voice heard on the mainstream or through mainstream media. So,
well, I mean, why would they cover your case when they could talk about the Kardashians?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I wanted to say that you were right. My case did start out had a political origin. Karl Rove, we had sworn testimony before the House Judiciary Committee that, you know, he was directly involved in the prosecution. The wife of his best friend was the U.S. attorney who investigated and brought me to trial, while her husband, Karl Rove's best friend, was running my opponent's campaign. You may remember that I won my reelection, but that night after the lights went out in a South Alabama Republican county, they took 5,000 of my votes, gave it to my opponent, refused to give me a recount, and I said, "Well, I'll live to fight another day." And when I started fighting is when the indictments started coming. I was brought to trial 1 month before the reelection campaign, and where I find myself now is in this particular peculiar situation, because during the trial, I kept telling my supporters, "Look, we're going to win the case, and then we'll win the race."
Right.
Because I knew that there wasn't anything that had gone on that I was embarrassed about or ashamed of. Certainly nothing illegal. But what I found at the end of the day was that, you know, this one of my staff members, who unbeknownst to me had been stealing money from people and shaking people down, turned as evidence after 70 interviews, CBS 60 Minutes actually did
right.
cover this story, and you know, exposed how the government's key witness had lied to get me convicted. And
I've never heard of such a thing, somebody being caught red-handed then agreeing to lie for the prosecution.
Yeah, how unusual is that, right? I remember reading a David Savage story in the Los Angeles Times a couple of years ago. In fact, I remember exactly when it was. It was January the 5th, 2010, and David wrote, yesterday, the President Obama's lawyers argued to the U.S. Supreme Court that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. It was in a case involving two men who had served 25 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit, and we're trying to get compensated from the government for 25 years of their lives. And, you know, here we have in 2010 the government arguing that it's okay to frame people.
Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, one way people can help you is by visiting your website, donsiegelman.org. That's SIEGELMAN.org.
Yes, and there's a place there to take action. And if they can subscribe and give us their email, assuming the worst while hoping for the best, assuming that I do get sent back to prison, my daughter Dana will be asking people to take action, and I would certainly appreciate your listeners going to my website, donsiegelman.org, and going to the take action and sign up. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank Tom Hartman. Tom and I have known each other for a good while now,
right.
And he's been a voice of support both for me and my family, for justice and for integrity, and it's so refreshing to have you guys on my side.
Well, and you've been in politics for quite a long time. Did you ever think in a million years that you would ever see things go this far just to win an election?
No, I did not. I think, you know, this is, you know, I keep thinking about when it started, and, you know, Karl Rove was working for Don Segretti in the White House in 1972 when they, you know, came up with all these dirty tricks.
Right.
And, you know, they invented the plumbers, which were the investigators who were going out to, you know, to set up wires and do dirty tricks. And
you've got the stories about him in Texas working against, I believe it was Governor Clement.
And Hightower, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he did the same thing in Texas that he did to me in Alabama. Interestingly enough, I know our time is short, but after George Hubert Walker Bush and Quayle lost in 92, Karl Rove and his best buddy, Bill Canary, moved to Alabama. They set up shop here. They both married girls from Alabama. Karl Rove moved to the Gulf Coast to a place called Rosemary Beach, a house which his wife probably now owns. But anyway, you know, they worked out of Alabama for a long time, and they did in Alabama to Alabama Supreme Court what Rove had done in Texas.
It's absolutely sick, Governor. We've got to cut it there. Go to his website, donsiegelman.org. That's SIEGELMAN. You can also follow him on Twitter at Don Siegelman. Governor, thanks for joining us. We've got your back here on the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're going to talk about getting an update from Brad Friedman about voter suppression around the country. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, all afternoon and tomorrow. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, wherever you want to find me. Joining me now is Brad Friedman. He runs the Brad Blog, which you should check out at bradblog.org. You can also find him on the Twitter device at the Brad Blog. He's got a piece up right now, if you go to his website, Truth About the GOP's Photo ID Fraud, the media watchdog, rather, Frumkin calls the MSM, the mainstream media out on the subject. And let me just read a little bit of it because I think it's fascinating. NPR is as much the problem as the rest of the corporate mainstream media. Here's how. Wade Goodwin of NPR's On Point summarized their, quote, battle over voter ID show from last Wednesday on their website. Quote, Republicans say new laws are necessary to prevent possible voter fraud. Democrats respond, it's a solution in search of a problem. There's no evidence of fraud except on the smallest of scales. And here's Brad writing, well, gosh, who knows what the truth is? Both sides lie, so the truth must be somewhere in the middle or something. Who can tell? Well, I can tell you who can tell. Brad Friedman can tell. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Carl, how are you, sir?
I'm well. I mean, it's bad enough when we get on the one side and on the other side journalism from people. But when it's on issues that are so important like this, it's just sickening, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the fundamental issue. And if the media can't tell the truth on this one, what can they be trusted to tell the truth on? But, you know, this is particularly true now in light of the stipulation that we saw last week in Pennsylvania, remarkable
right.
stipulation, you know, where the Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth, who's on trial right now for this Republican photo ID restriction, where, you know, the state admitted they are aware of absolutely no in-person voter fraud in Pennsylvania's history, or in any other state, or in any other state's history. And they went on to say that even without the photo ID law this November, they expect there to be no in-person impersonation voter fraud, you know, even without this law in place. So, I mean,
I'll tell you, there is state-sanctioned voter fraud in every election. And I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now. Let me explain what I mean, Brad, because I don't want to get people confused and outraged out there. I'm not saying that people are stealing votes and whatnot. What I'm saying is that whenever you show up to vote and you have to wait in line for 3.5 hours, that's voter fraud. It's voter intimidation. Whenever your polling place is shut down and combined with the county, you know, a polling place from another town over, that's voter fraud. Whenever, you know, the polling places in urban areas are combined to so few polling places that you can't figure out where it is you're supposed to vote, that's voter fraud. When a polling place runs out of ballots, that's voter fraud. When a polling place forces you to vote with a, you know, one of those, you know, different colored ballots because they're not sure if you registered, that's voter fraud.
Yeah.
But here's how you can tell the motivations of these voter ID pushing Republican politicians. Not one of them, while proposing these voter ID laws, has ever put forward legislation or combined legislation that would make it easier for people that they deem registered voters to actually cast a vote.
That's right. And I will correct you only on one thing there, Carl, that litany of fraud you detailed, and you're absolutely right on all of those issues. That's actually not voter fraud. That's election fraud.
Election, I mean, right, election fraud.
Cases, well, it's important to underscore, because voters are doing fine. We need to leave them alone. This is, you know, the problem is people running these elections, trying to game these elections. And you're right. In Ohio, in 2008, 40,000 provisional ballots went uncounted, many of them because the poll worker directed the voter to put the ballot at the wrong table in the right polling place. And those votes were thrown out. Those were never counted. So you're right. There are tens, if not hundreds of thousands, or maybe more votes, you know, that are thrown out, legal votes that are thrown out each year, and this is absolutely
fraud. Well, and let's not,
fraud.
Let's be clear. I mean, a lot of the times, the mistakes at polling places are not motivated by politics. The state doesn't spend enough money to train people and have enough people that know how to conduct elections running these things. I grew up in California, so by the time I got to other states and saw how they did it, I was shocked. I voted in the same polling place for a number of elections when I was growing, you know, when I was, you know, in my late teens and 20s. It was always the same people running the polling place. They were reasonably, you know, knowledgeable about how things went. But then I go into other places where they've never worked an election cycle, they're volunteers, whatever. Do you think it would be refreshing if just once one of these Republican Secretary of States would come out and say, okay, we're going to do voter ID, but we're also going to have state-funded poll workers who are trained and pass a test so that they show that they know how to conduct elections. We're going to pay them something that is suitable for a day's work, and we're going to have independent inspectors at every polling place, and every precinct is going to have a polling place.
Well, listen, if they got rid of these horrible electronic voting systems and counters that cannot be relied on,
right,
the money that we could save from that alone, we could afford to pay these poll workers properly. And listen, I don't want to beat up on the poll workers because I think they're great patriotic volunteers. But the fact of the matter is, many states and counties just don't go out of their way to train folks properly or pay them properly, as you suggest. And then when there are mistakes that do happen, as in Ohio, you know, where they've combined all of these polling places, all of these precincts into a single polling place, and through no fault of the voters, they are forced to cast a provisional ballot to then not count that as a matter of law, and that is currently the law in the state of Ohio, is just an absolute outrage. We're talking 40,000 votes not counted. Legally cast, but not counted in 2008 in Ohio.
And when the governor of Pennsylvania can't even tell you what kind of identification is acceptable to vote?
Not just the governor, but the Secretary of State. They call her the Secretary of the Commonwealth out there. She was appointed by that governor. It's just a coincidence that she happens to be married to the governor's chief of staff. She's the top election official in the state of Pennsylvania, where some 1.6 million voters are likely to be affected by this law if it stands this November. And she says, quote, I haven't looked at the law. I don't know what's in the law, she said. She's in charge of overseeing this law, and that's what she said during testimony in the trial this week.
Well, Brad, at least she's running, at least, you know, the Secretary of State's office in Pennsylvania, just like every other state that's pushed these laws through, they're running, you know, a heavy buy of PSAs on television to explain to people exactly what they should do, and they're running ads online and sending out lots of mail to make sure everybody impacted by the law will know what to do, right?
Well, that's not happening. They have spent $200,000 to do just exactly that in Pennsylvania. Where did that money go? Well, it went to a Mitt Romney funder. And what they got for that $200,000 was a couple of videos that they slapped up somewhere on the web, to warn these people that these 1.6 million legal voters, that within 100 days, they better find a way to get photo ID or they're not going to be able to cast a vote for the presidential
election. Well, and for 200, first of all, let's talk about the ripoff of costing $200,000 to produce a couple web videos. Remarkable ripoff.
Half the price, Carl.
There are people out there that would have done a video for $5,000 and done it well, especially with the tools on anybody's laptop. Not to mention, if you spent $200,000 on television, this shows you how little they care about making sure people know about this. If you spent $200,000 on television commercials in Philadelphia, you would have reached a pittance of the people impacted by this law. They should, when they change the laws so drastically, they should be spending millions to educate people about them.
Absolutely. And I mean, especially with.
And by the way, I don't think that we should have these voter ID laws. I'm just saying if they were going to even try to mask this political calculation as something good for the state, they would do this.
Let me just correct you on a little bit of language here. You know, you've referred to it as voter ID laws. Well, in fact, most states already have voter ID laws. They're reasonable laws, however, that allow you to show, you know, a bank statement, a paycheck stub, and so forth. As a matter of fact, first-time voters who don't register at the clerk's office already have to show voter ID by federal law in all 50 states. So voter ID laws in and of themselves aren't the problem. And I think a lot of people hear, oh, voter ID, that sounds reasonable. What they don't understand is we're not talking about reasonable ID. We're talking about very narrowly defined state-issued photo ID that is now required in many of these states purposely by these Republicans who know that some 22 million legal voters in America do not have that specific type of ID. This is voter suppression out and out. There's no question about it, and that's why
wasn't it Texas?
Dan Frumkin's article is so great, calling on the media to, you know, call it for what it is.
Wasn't it Texas that allowed hunting licenses to be used but not student IDs?
That's right. Concealed carry licenses, that's fine, but a student ID, sorry, pal, you're out of luck.
It's just outrageous. Brad, I want to plug your show on Pacifica out there. When does it air again?
Thank you, sir. Wednesdays, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can listen in live at kpfk.org every Wednesday.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brad Friedman, you must read his blog, bradblog.com. Follow him on Twitter, at thebradblog. Brad Friedman, thanks for joining me. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch, and we will be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, I'm talking to Cal Penn, the actor and one of the co-chairs of Obama 2012. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program for our final segment of the day. Filling in for Tom Hartman, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Here all afternoon, and I'll be back again tomorrow. Joining me now is Cal Penn. He is an actor you might remember from the Harold and Kumar movies or from House, one of my favorite television shows that just left the air. He also happens to be campaign co-chair for Obama 2012, and he was in London for the Olympics. Cal, how are you?
Good. How are you, Tom? Thanks for having me on.
I'm good. It's Carl here and for Tom today, but I'm curious.
Oh, Carl, I'm sorry.
Oh, don't worry about it. I'm curious how your meeting with the MI6 went.
Well, if I met with them, I wouldn't be able to talk about it.
Really? I didn't know that was part of protocol. Apparently Mitt Romney didn't know that either, but...
Right.
How did you find London while you were there for the opening ceremonies and whatnot?
I loved London. I was actually excited to go there. There was a global leaders conference that a bunch of former White House staffers actually put on called the Global Impact Initiative that worked with NGOs and so on. But obviously inescapable were all of the news headlines really from like the day after I landed about what, you know, how badly Governor Romney had offended our allies in the UK. It was just shocking.
It was wall to wall. I mean, what I found interesting was that people, you know, some conservatives were saying that they were treating Romney so unfairly in the English press. And well, aside from the fact that most of what they said was true about, you know, what he'd done, those types of headlines, if Mitt Romney is offended by those types of headlines, he's going to have much thicker skin if he wants to be commander in chief. What do you think it says? You know, you often hear right wingers, Fox Newsers, conservative talk radio hosts say, even Mitt Romney, the president needs to stop apologizing for America, quote unquote. Do you think it would be easier for the president to, quote unquote, stop apologizing for America if people like Mitt Romney and Republicans weren't out there embarrassing us abroad?
Well, look, obviously the president doesn't apologize for America.
Obviously, right.
So what I thought was, and look, obviously articles like this or headlines like that are designed to be amusing and draw the reader in. But what is, you know, sort of disheartening on a substantive level are the things that, you know, Governor Romney did and said. You don't go criticize, you know, one of our strongest allies over their preparation for the Olympics, and then, you know, that causes a rebuke from Prime Minister Cameron and the Mayor of London. And there were sort of other things that I saw, you know, there were
criticizing President Obama overseas.
Well, right, that's something else. And also, you know, I remember in 2008 when the president was, you know, then senator, you know, made it a priority to visit men and women serving in war zones like Iraq and Afghanistan. And I didn't see, you know, Governor Romney take any time out of his fundraising and ally offending schedule to visit any of our troops overseas. So it's just sort of things like that are actually substantive beyond just a funny headline that are worrisome. His trip went from bad to worse.
Well, I think it's
I think definitely.
I think it speaks to kind of the mentality in Camp Romney. I mean, during the last campaign, when they asked his sons why they hadn't served in Iraq if they were in favor of the war, they said because they were, you know, doing a higher calling by helping their father run for president. So, at a certain point, there's this disconnection, and it's been said that there's this disconnect between Romney and the American people because he's kind of awkward. How much of it do you think it is that he just doesn't get the plight of people here in the United States who are actually hurting?
I think there's definitely a disconnect there. I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of the foreign trip, I think it was clear that he showed the American people and really, I guess, the rest of the world he wasn't ready to be commander in chief. You know, you in public or private meetings, obviously there are a whole bunch of nuances related to foreign policy that he didn't seem to grasp either publicly or privately.
Right.
And then when it comes to just the contrast between the president, right, the president and first lady paid off their student loans recently because they worked hard. They had to take out those loans, and they understand what it's like. And that's why the president fought so hard for things like the Pell Grant.
Well, you know what? That's not very fair, Cal, because if Mitt Romney's president, my gosh, nobody will ever pay off their student loans, and that is a guarantee.
The worrisome thing about it, you know, his only plan, as far as I've seen it in a youth rally that he had done a few months ago, was he was asked the question, you know, what do I do about college affordability? And to a young person, he said, well, you know, shop around for the cheapest tuition. And now we already do that.
Right. He also said borrow money from your parents.
Long ago. Well, right. And I mean, it's sort of like, well, how do we equalize the playing field? There are so many brilliant young men and women in this country, innovators, artists, engineers that are working so hard trying to start their own companies, trying to get an education, whether it's college or trade school or military service. And the president has just done so much, I think, frankly, because he understands where they're coming from.
Right.
And I just don't, I don't see that from Governor.
Well, he's trying to give relief to students so that they can afford to go to school, so that he can inspire, a next generation of scientists and doctors and teachers and police and firefighters. Mitt Romney seeks to inspire a generation of payday lenders, because that's the only way people are going to be able to afford college under a President Romney. It's interesting when you look at how he tries to appeal to these different groups with, things that might sound normal to a Romney but don't necessarily ring true to an average person. Ask your parents for money.
I feel like
It's not only that, it's also that these are, you know, these are economic policies that have been tried and have failed. They're the things that led us to this financial crisis in the first
right.
place. So it's not just a question of
it
things
is.
That we don't think makes common sense. It's also just factually speaking economically disastrous if we're continuing to give tax breaks to the wealthy and to oil companies and not funding things like education and science and manufacturing and green technology and the list.
Precisely right. It is George W. Bush on steroids, just like his advisor said it would be. Cal Penn, the actor and co-chair of Obama 2012, thanks for joining me. Follow him on Twitter at Cal Penn, and also Obama, obviously, on Twitter as well. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. We'll talk about solutions-based unionism. Plus, author Dean Koontz stops by with his latest book, Odd Apocalypse, has just hit the stands. And we'll have the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Video archives, go to TomHartman.com.